So it's really a great pleasure to talk at this event. For me, this group, this institution, has always been one of the centers of inspiration. So I'm going to talk today. One of the things Carl once said to me, I can't remember exactly how he put it. He may remember better. He says, the difference between you and me, Neil, is you like to talk about what people should do, and I just like to get on and do it, which I think is broadly correct. It came out probably a bit harsher than it was actually intended at the time. So I'm going to do a bit of that today. As Carl says, I do like to try and step back, and this is very much a step back talk. So I want to start with what I've decided to call the great AI fallacy. So something funny happened to us as a field, because we were just machine learning people, and I'm really very naturally an engineer. I was just trying to solve problems. And I got into this field, and then overnight, because a couple of labs who were doing just machine learning suddenly called themselves artificial intelligence, right? Just like that. The whole field became AI. And because I was an expert in machine learning, almost instantaneously, I became an expert in artificial intelligence. And I'd never been interested in the question of what is intelligence as some kind of separated from problems or whatever else. But I felt myself forced to. And what I want to call the great AI fallacy is really comes from trying to understand what people are saying when they talk about AI that makes it different from anything else. And the best way I have of putting that is that when people talk about AI, I think that they are making it out to be, so what I think is AI is just automated decision making, automation of intellectual effort, algorithmic decision making. And we've automated a lot of stuff before. So what's different? Well, I think people are saying that this is the first generation of automation where the automation is going to adapt to us rather than us adapting to the automation. So what do I mean by that? If you go backwards through history and see it, look at the sort of things we've automated, like manual work, the way we do it is we work out a task that we can get a machine to repeat, and we have that machine repeat the task, and the humans feed it. So the humans have to adapt to the machine. So the first thing you do when you're automating is you control the environment around that machine, because that machine isn't adaptable. It can't accommodate all the things that humans can. And the humans fall into the service of that machine. So my understanding is that, you know, clocks really became only important when we had trains, because it was important to know a universal time was then important for trains moving around. So before trains, you could just turn up whenever you like, I guess, you know. But trains force you to conform to clocks. Factories force you to turn up at 6 o'clock and leave at 6 o'clock. So our lives have sort of been turned around. We're not allowed to go on railways, and in the United States, you're not even allowed to go on roads to allow vehicles. Our life has been pushed by automation to a more constrained state. Now, when I hear what people are saying, and I think I'm the only person I've heard explicitly say this, but I think implicitly they're implying that. And I think that's a fallacy. I think there's no evidence that we've done that or we're anywhere near close to achieving it. And I think that unless you remember that's a fallacy, you're going to have some pretty incorrect impressions about how things are going to move forward. And today's talk is really about, I think, how some of that effects manifest themselves. So I was thinking on Wednesday, because, of course, when you're asked to do a really honorific talk like this, it's a great honor, and you think, well, I really have to tell them something interesting. I'm going to spend a lot of time composing and creating this talk, and it's going to be something new that I speak about for the first time. And then 2 days before the talk, you think, crumbs, I've got about 3 hours to get this done. But you're always hoping something comes to you. And actually, on Wednesday morning, I was listening to Radio 4 while making the breakfast, the Today program, and there were three stories that I heard that I think are somewhat connected. And I'm going to try and connect them. Maybe it won't work. But those three stories were, one was that Sir Ian Diamond, who's now the national statistician, said that the next census may be the last. So we're going to have a census soon, I don't know, how soon, but he said that the next one may be the last, that in 10 years' time we may turn away from census and we'll start using other data sources to try and recreate the census. And I actually sat next to Ian Diamond in a national data strategy meeting once, and he seems like a very reasonable person. This isn't a machine learning person saying this, this is our national statistician. So that was story one. Story two was Ofcom. Ofcom were being handed regulatory powers to intervene in social media. So being given the power to say this type of content is inappropriate and that they should have the ability to take action. What action that's going to be, we don't know. But I think this is what actually happens in the States. I think that the fine on Facebook was a telecommunications fine, the telecommunications regulator. So I thought that was sort of interesting. And then story three was, I think a guy called Carson Brooks, who's from Muddy Waters, which is a short seller, was talking about a company, which was a health company. And he was talking about, this company had grown very, very quickly and got into the FTSE 100. And he believed that this company was somewhat of a dud. And in the interview, he was being asked about accounting. And he was being asked, well, have they misrepresented their accounts? And he was very clear that the line between illegal accounting and accounts that misrepresent in the benefit of the board is a sort of gray area. And I was reminded of Carillion and Patisserie Valerie and other companies that have collapsed in recent times due to accounts that are being presented, not illegally, I think maybe some of it was illegal, but I think often not illegally, but arising as this challenge that people are now talking about, that the big four accountants are also consultants. And so they're in this quite cozy relationship with very large firms because they're getting paid to do consulting and they're perhaps not doing the auditing to the level they should do. And these three are the things that I think are connected, and I'm going to try and connect them to AI. The thing that happened a few weeks before that is I was having a coffee with Bill Thompson, who's here. Bill, I think, is like a one-man Cambridge institution. There's many institutions here. There's the colleges and there's Bill Thompson. And he was telling me about, I didn't know about the Tanner lectures. And I was describing the sort of thing I want to work on. And I'd actually kind of been seeking a word for it and said, and Bill said, Jonathan Zittrain calls this intellectual debt. And I said, that is exactly the word I need to describe the phenomena that I'm most worried about. Intellectual debt. So, Jonathan, did anyone here go to the Tanner lectures? See, there's not enough overlap. There you go, you've got a clear point of issue, that the Tanner lectures are targeted in this area, but more coming from the social sciences perspective. But unless we're connecting as technologists with those lectures and correcting the misunderstandings of what the technology is, we're not going to go to very good places. But I think that this is a really important idea. So intellectual debt was the sort of, as soon as Bill said it, I said, oh, that's my talk title for the distinguished lecture in a month's time, and I emailed Matt immediately afterwards. So I'm going to come back to what intellectual debt is, but I'm going to start with technical debt. Who here has heard of technical debt? Okay, so that's about 30% of you. So the notion of technical debt is very emergent from this era of big software. So in technical debt, the idea is that with software, you're very often under pressure to bring a product to market. So there's something called lean startup methodology. Anyone heard about this? Less of you. Okay. So the idea in lean startup methodology is, okay, so this isn't like a machine learning or an AI startup, because in lean startup methodology, you actually have a product. or a blockchain startup. That's not a product, machine learning or AI. No, your idea is you have something that you believe people want, right? And this thing is going to solve a customer need. And what you're trying to do is find out as quickly as possible if you're right, right? So you don't want to sort of spend ages building and designing this thing, then you put it in the market and no one cares, right? So in lean startup methodology, you build the thing as quickly as possible, you take all the shortcuts just to get it out and test the market, right? And then, of course, if it flops, you maybe got some information, you can try something else. Technical debt comes when it succeeds. Because you were rushing to deploy, people love your thing, but you didn't build a software architecture to maintain this thing at the scale you now need to. And you know, cloud compute has given you the compute capability to scale, so you've probably got that okay, but all of a sudden, what happens is as your user base goes up, you end up having to scale your teams in order to manage and support this thing. So it's called technical debt, because the notion is you've built something that is difficult, you've borrowed from the future. You've said, I'm gonna put less technical effort in today in anticipation of this does realize, I'm gonna have to pay it back with maintenance. So it's actually a very sensible decision. Like, if you haven't worked in a startup or in a product environment, this thing, oh, we should design it properly. No, it's a sensible decision, because if you borrow and your product isn't successful, you never have to pay it back, right? So it's a sensible decision, but it pushes you in this position of not being able to maintain what you've done. Now, intellectual debt is like that, but it's different. It goes to the heart of, I think, that this very important book, The Mythical Man Month, which is 1975, which is, you know, well, it should be Person Month, right? But it's 1975, and it's about the challenges with large-scale software projects. Many of you may have heard of it. But the notion is that as you increase the size of your software engineering team, the time dedicated to the project just goes up. You don't gain that back in terms of effort, because there's things like communication overhead going on. And this was a major problem with large-scale software projects. I mean, I can't remember, we spent $10 billion trying to build a unified data system for the NHS that was just canceled. You know, shocking waste of money, not being able to scale large software projects. Now, the interesting thing is, I think broadly, I would say 10 years ago, 12 years ago, we probably felt that we were on top of this challenge. And the way we address this challenge is what one would call separation of concerns. So separation of concerns is a methodology where the way you construct is you don't build big teams. So say in Amazon, they have this idea of a two pizza team, which is a team size that you can feed with two pizzas. Now, you'd think that therefore it would vary country to country, but it's American cultural imperialism. So these are two American pizzas, not Italian pizzas. And so that's a team they reckon 6 to 12. Right? And what you do is you define the team's inputs and outputs, and you have them operate in an agile software way. You do very little intervention other than this is the specification of what we want you to build. So the key objective is to decompose your task into a series of tasks that you can have a small 8 to 12 person team operate. And this works very well in the context of a service-oriented architecture as well. So what people have evolved towards is that you test what that team has produced by heavy software testing, so test-oriented development. Everything they're doing, they write the tests before they write, pair programming, always supervising each other. But the object that is produced, they own. Now, this to me is interesting because I think it's creating this problem of intellectual debt. And I haven't even mentioned data and machine learning yet. So the problem that this creates is even if we get that out and it's beautifully designed from a maintainability perspective, separation of concerns means no one is concerned with the whole system. That's the idea. The problem with the mythical man month approach is that you have to have everyone knowing everything that's going on in the system, or someone's knowing that, and people are saying, no, you can't do that over here. Everything becomes interconnected. So separation of concerns is about making it independent. Do the decomposition. People go ahead and do what they want to do, however they want to do it. So intellectual debt is the inability to explain your software system. So you end up with this case that even if it works, you're deploying something that you can't explain. And, you know, I think my favorite, it's least favorite, because I think it was a shocking example of this, the extent to that companies don't even realize this has happened. So if you look post the US election, Mark Zuckerberg said it was a crazy idea that the Russians could have interfered with the election. It's about, I think, 10 months later, when Facebook revealed the extent to which the Russians did interfere on Facebook in the US election. So that's a 10-month process. And I don't think that was they found that out within a week. and then they were just stalling on deploying it for 10 months. I think that the actual process of explaining what went on and what the processes of interconnected things was 10 months, because there's no one individual that had the full understanding of the system. And so this is intellectual debt. So I did mechanical engineering, so I'm actually a real engineer at heart, none of this. I'd just like to be back 200 years ago where we had engines, we could measure their power and all that sort of stuff. And we can't. I mean, that's the challenge we're facing now. So if you are a civil engineer and you're working on a project of this scale of complexity, let's not get arrogant as software engineers and believe that we're doing something that is that much more complex. I don't think we are. I think that those projects themselves, I've worked in supply chain, the supply chain for those projects, the ideas around just-in-time delivery, all this type of stuff is immensely complex. But they have one enormous advantage that as software engineers we don't have, that they can look out the window of their porter cabin and see what the bridge looks like. If you have a software engineer tell you, yeah, that bit's done, what does done mean? You can't look at it. You can't walk it. Now, in manufacturing and supply chain, and in Amazon, like the senior leaders are so proud of doing this, and they talk about it all the time. It's a Japanese idea, the idea of a Gemba walk, that you actually go to the factory floor, and you look at what's going on, and you inspect it yourself. And so all senior leaders in Amazon who are in the supply chain side will be doing this, because it's a way of finding out when there are defects that are not defects that are being surfaced towards you. In software, this doesn't exist. You can't walk the software in that way. I mean, you can, but it involves going into every team's individual code base and having a look at what they've written. I mean, you've got processes in place like code review and code standards to try and get this working as best as possible, but that's not operating at the VP level. The VP can't walk around in the same way that you can walk around an Amazon fulfillment center or a manufacturing facility. So this is the sort of thing that is driving intellectual debts. I think the way that I wasn't at John's lecture, and I was trying to watch it back, but it's 2 hours long, and it's not on YouTube, so you can't double the speed. So if I had watched it, you wouldn't have got a talk. But my understanding is when he's talking about machine learning and AI and intellectual debt, he's talking about the lack of explainabilities of individual models. He's not talking about the system. I'm not worried about the lack of explainability of an individual model. I'm not at all worried about that. We have plenty of techniques. We're developing those techniques to do that. We're not doing it, but we will be able to do it. What I'm worried about is when you're deploying, through separation of concerns, a series of models which are being composed together. And this is where Bill's sort of, as I was describing this to him, he said, oh, this is like Death of the Author, which hopefully, I'll come back to him. So Death of the Author is an essay from 1967, The Literary Criticism. And it's sort of a play on, it's a French essay, so it's a play on La Mort d'Arthur. So I guess it's La Mort de l'Auteur. I can't really speak French. But it's a sort of little play. It doesn't work as well in English, The Death of Arthur, The Death of the Author. But the notion in the essay, The Death of the Author, is that in literary criticism, the point that was made is that you should not take the author's background into consideration when interpreting the work, that the author loses control of their work. So the author, having created the work is to be interpreted, and this is a position. I don't know about literary criticism. I wonder if anyone here does. But the interpretation is that once it's written, the work exists on its own. It is out of the control of the author. So the notion here is the death of the programmer. Because in this service-oriented architecture, where we're all building an individual service that I have deployed, once I have deployed it as a set of programmers or programmer, the authors of that service lose control about it. How that service will be consumed in the real world is not within their control. That's the whole point. So once you have deployed your software engineering piece of technology, you've lost control. So that's the notion of the death of the programmer. It's not like if you're creating Microsoft Word, where you know how everything's piecing together. In these service-oriented architectures, which is how we're building very large-scale systems today, once you've deployed, it's gone. What happens in practice is how these problems seem to be dealt with, because, of course, this is leading to problems without machine learning. And what I've noticed is that what you tend to get is a sort of Lancelot character. And Lancelot is like a software engineer who has been in the organization long enough to know the type of things that go wrong when you mess with this system. Right? They've been around 15 years, or, I mean, in Amazon's case, some of these systems are 26 years old, you know. They've been around that long time, and every time you want to change the system, you have to ask Lancelot. Say, Lancelot, am I allowed to change this? And he says, no, this dragon will arise, and you can't do that. We tried that back in 2008. But this totally undermines the functioning and flexibility of the system, because you're taking this independent system and you put in, without knowing it, people don't notice they've done this. It just naturally evolves. Like a leader, Arthur in this case is the sort of VP running the subsystem. And Arthur works out over time that if the knights go amiss with the system without getting Lancelot involved, something goes wrong. And then eventually Lancelot's just got too many dragons on his list and he can't answer all the queries he's getting to deal with the software. So actually things end up locked down. And actually, you can't explain, like, any minor query, you don't even look at it. You're only trying to deal with the big things on the system. So what does adding data do to these circumstances? Well, adding data is causing really serious problems. There's multiple things going on, and some of them are cultural, and some of them are to do with the nature of these new components. So what we're doing now is we're taking these pre-existing software engineering components that were programmed by an individual with somewhat deterministic behavior, and we're allowing them to learn from data. So point number one is that the data they learn from, obviously, at the moment of deployment, will evolve, often in response to the fact that you've deployed that component. So there's a nice project at Glasgow called Closed Loop Data Science, where Rod Murray-Smith is looking at this problem. But in practice, people aren't even declaring that they have deployed a machine learning component. There is no way within the service-oriented architecture to say, by the way, in this subcomponent, there's a machine learning component. So this subcomponent is going to go stale. It's going to be out of date. It's got sell-by date. Previously, you didn't have a sell-by date. The software would just sit there ticking along. Yet, people don't get rewarded for saying, hey, we need a new mechanism for a sell-by date. They get rewarded for deploying minimum viable product. So there's an issue there that these things are going out of date, which is a maintenance issue. There's another issue around the... what's the next issue? Sorry, now I have to check my notes. By the way, there are notes. While I'm checking my notes, if you search for my talks, you'll see that I've written all of this up in a sort of long post under my talks. Yes. This is a weird one. In the rush to adopt AI, very good, highly technical people have swallowed the AI fallacy. People who normally are the ones whose skepticism is saying, what are you deploying? Why are you doing this? Have been trained, stop doing that. Don't get in the way of these highly paid machine learning engineers that have just left university and have no understanding of how a large complex software system works. Allow them to deploy their weird, funky model in TensorFlow without any of the normal checks. So not only are they not doing proper test-oriented software engineering, they're not questioning how to test the output of that model itself. They're not questioning, how do I have an ongoing set of runtime tests that say that this is doing what it was designed to do on day one? Thirdly, of course, each of these individual models itself has the potential to introduce bias or challenges in the system because they are being data-driven. So even the choice of data that has been inserted is being made according to some assumptions about what the real world's like. So, of course, data can go out of date, but even if it stays within date, you're making assumptions about what data you collected to deploy. So there's a sort of area in... there's an area in machine learning which isn't normally called fit models, but I had to go through the trauma on the NIPS board, of Neurips board, sorry, of renaming a conference because it was inappropriately named. And we decided to name one of our conferences Fat Models, So I think that we shouldn't do that. And so this is an alternative acronym for what you sometimes hear about as fat learning. I think it's a better acronym because it suits better. So this is fairness, accountability, and transparency would be fat. This is, I'm saying, fairness, interpretability, and transparency. So fit models. So there's a lot of people getting excited about fit models in terms of, actually, that's bad as well. Okay, FET models. Fairness, explainability, and transparency. Damn it. Everything's a minefield nowadays. FET models. So I know that's transistors too. Fairness, explainability, and transparency in models is actually about whether I can deploy an individual model and say something about its fairness, or the bias it's exhibiting, or why it made a particular decision. Right? This is a really emerging, interesting field. I think virtually no models have been deployed in this state. And in some sense, the whole premise of the field is broken because of the death of the programmer. Because I can build and deploy a model which has a context that I believe in, that is fair according to the circumstances in which I know that this model will be used, or I believe this model will be used. But if I'm deploying it within a service-oriented architecture, I have lost control over what people are going to do with that downstream. So my proof of the fairness of this model is contingent on the output I am, the single output I'm using being the relevant output. In reality, my model is likely to be feeding another model, which is going to be feeding another model. So you get this composition of models within these ecosystems, and it's the fairness of the system you care about, not the fairness of the model. So it's fit systems we need to do. And the big challenge that I'm interested in is how do we get in a state where we can even begin to address that, because we are nowhere near. Exception. If you are in a situation where you've got a piece of hardware and you're deploying these type of systems within a single piece of hardware, prime air drones would be an example of this, or a robot or something like this, this is very well done. This is very well done because you control the whole thing end to end. But that is not what happens when you're deploying a large-scale software system where the whole idea is you're allowing this flexibility. So this really feeds into the challenges around intellectual debt because of the death of the programmer and the fact that what the end decision of the system, so you may think you're making an insignificant decision according to, say, GDPR regulations. That means you don't have to check for fairness of discrimination around one of your inputs, which might be a geographical region, which could be associated with particular ethnicities. But when you deploy your model, someone consumes your output and puts it into a system that is making a significant decision. But they don't know that you were taking a geographical region as your input. So they don't know to check for fairness around the geographical regions, because they don't know that your output is actually contingent on a geographical region. These are the sort of problems that come up. And they're going to keep coming up. So this is a solution that we hammered out with collaborators when I was at Amazon, which we call data-oriented architectures. So in a software-oriented architecture, what you care about is an ecosystem of these independent software components. In a data-oriented architecture, we move to a new world where what you care about is the data flows between those components. And I'm very excited that since I left, Amazon have actually open-sourced BSD licensed the first example of what we're calling, I think, a modern data-oriented programming language. So what is the idea with this thing? So we call this Milan. Why, there's a fun story about why it's called Milan. It's in this space, we will not be able to do anything top-down. We will not be able to impose upon people, you now need to take our constrained way of building software and apply it to your systems so that you can be safer, more secure, more explainable. They won't do it. The only way we have of doing this is if people want to use the stuff you're producing because it's useful. So that led to what we call the shiny bike model. So the shiny bike model of what we're trying to do here is you build something that is nice enough that people want to steal it. And you just leave it unlocked outside your front door. And they steal it because they want the shiny bike. But embedded in the bike, embedded in the thing that they've stolen, become these security checks around what's going on. So that's the shiny bike model. And Tom, who led on the production of Milan, Eric, who's in the audience, did some of the coding on it. He's now a PhD student with me. He said that the oldest still existing bicycle manufacturer in the world is Bianchi, and they're based in Milan, which is why the language is called Milan. So what is Milan? So what it is at the moment is, at the top level, it's a general purpose stream algebra that encodes relationships between data streams. So, and that's what's called the Milan intermediate language. This is the most important thing from what I'm describing. So I'm so excited to be, although I'm an engineer at heart, you know, it was funny, I was in the computer lab in like 98 to 2000 doing my PhD, but there wasn't really anyone doing machine learning then, and I was often over here, or I was in Dave Mackay's lab in the Cavendish learning things there. But right today, I couldn't be excited to be, much that I love engineering, anywhere other than the computer lab, because what I really think is the next stage to solve these problems is a revolution in computer science. I actually really care very little for the new modeling developments that people are making in machine learning. I care about them a bit, like in the way I like doing Sudoku and crosswords and things like that. I don't like doing those because I like playing with Gaussian processes. But, you know, we're not going to change the world by tweaking these little models and coming up with extra performance improvements. The next step that we need to address is, what are the implications for these models we built for the subject, the domain of computer science? And they're radical. Because at the most fundamental level, what we're doing, computer science is all based on separate data and code. Okay, and as soon as I said that, you realize what's gone wrong. Separate data and code. All security flaws are to do with people finding ways to inject data into code regions. And what we're doing with machine learning is we're explicitly inviting data into the code, because the software systems we're building are now being driven by data rather than code. Now, I think there are things we can do to handle this, and Milan is at the heart of that, but that really radically changes the way you think about a lot of computer science. And one of those areas is, so we're starting to work with Marcello Fiore in computer science, who's a category theorist, around this intermediate language. So the notion is that we build a very formal category theory-based language of how data is interconnecting across this service-oriented architecture. That's the key idea at the bottom of a data-oriented architecture. So we understand how everything is joined up. We require the designer to do that. The individual software teams aren't doing that. The designer at the start has to do that. The individual software teams conform to this programming language, and they're still capable of doing TensorFlow or whatever things they want to do, whatever crazy models. We don't impose constraints on that. All we say is that whatever you're doing, it has to be stateless in the sense, of course, all these models have state, but in the sense that you must not store state separately from the Milan ecosystem. The Milan ecosystem must know what your state is, so it can see your parameters, where they've been stored. It doesn't know what model you've got, necessarily. It can see your inputs, and it can see where your output's going. Now, that is the sort of, the algebra that encodes that is at the core of this thing. And the notion here is that you will want to be able to translate that algebra for different purposes. You want a view of that algebra that you can show to your vice president to say, this is our software architecture. So you don't have to keep updating the documentation of how things are joined. You want a view of that architecture that you show to the information commissioner's office to say, look, we can show you that this significant decision we're making about individuals here is in no way dependent on any personal data about their ethnicity, their gender, their health status, their sexuality, their religion. So we conform to GDPR in making this decision. I mean, at the moment, people can't do that without months of looking through what's there for each decision. So around that, though, to make it practical, are two things. A Scala library for building programs in that algebra. And this is out there open source already in its sort of alpha or pre-alpha version. So that's the Scala library. And the next thing to do will be to build a Python library. So basically, you're going to have regular programming languages that you can compile to Milan. And then underneath that, a compiler that takes the programs expressed in the intermediate languages and compiles them to the relevant streaming service, which in the moment we're using Apache Flink, which is a service-oriented architecture, data streaming, systems management. But there's multiple ones of these things. So that's the core thing. And the important thing about that is that now gives us the context of each of these models in a programmatic, formal way. So once we've got the context, we can start to infer even what that model must be doing. We don't have to tell the programmer, please explain to us exactly what your intent was here. Because actually, they probably can't. But we can see what their inputs are, we can see what their output is, and we know something about where those inputs came from. We can start labeling each of those inputs with information. This is a time series, this is a geographical location, and we can start to infer what must be going on in this system automatically. So we've replaced Lancelot with like an auto Lancelot type of thing, the ability to go into the system and work out what's going on. So this is a domain I call auto AI. Why do I call it auto AI? Because I think that's the sort of catchy name that might make people pay attention. No, it's trying to contrast it with auto ML. So auto ML, I do love the field of auto ML, and you know, we've done a little bits of it. But the idea in auto ML is that once you've got a data set, you know, and you want to know what model to train on this data set, auto ML automatically chooses and trains the model for you, setting the hyperparameters, and you get the best performance. The silly thing about AutoML, much as I love it as a field, is the only bit people like doing in machine learning is training the model. They don't like doing the bit where you get the data set and clean it up and everything else. They like fiddling around with models and playing with that. So we automated the only bit that's fun. And it's still going to be the humans that have to sit there spending all their time cleaning and generating the data. Once you've got an ecosystem like this in auto AI, the right data set should start to become obvious from the ecosystem itself. And it's all within the ecosystem. So you can start extracting and sampling data from within the ecosystem, and you can start retraining models as appropriate by resampling that data a second time. This is the type of thing we envisage happening. And how's that going to happen? Well, with meta-modeling. This is the other key component to auto AI. Or sometimes, if I wanted to call it something else, I'd call it Bayesian systems optimization rather than Bayesian optimization. Because it's instead of optimizing a component in the system, which is what Bayesian optimization does, you're trying to optimize the system as a whole and trying to understand the upstream and downstream effects of your optimization. So another piece of software the team built at Amazon is called EmuKit, and this is actually a meta-modeling framework. Now, of course, naturally, in my team, we choose to do meta-modeling with Gaussian process models because they seem very appropriate for it, and we've done a lot of exciting things with Gaussian process models for meta-modeling, but I don't care how you do it. The point is you need a meta-model, a model above your model. You need to start doing machine learning. I mean, that's how people are doing explainability anyway. So how do I do explainability? I take a complex model, and then I look at it, and I linearize around its operating point, and I explain what's going on at that operating point. I mean, I know that's a publication somewhere, but it's not that clever. I mean, it's obvious, right? And it's kind of obvious because that's what statisticians do anyway, right? One of the things that machine learning people forget about is statisticians don't fit linear models to complex systems because they think it's linear. They do that for interpretability, right? And they spend a lot of time looking at the parameters, trying to understand what the influence of each of these inputs is so that they have an interpretable model. The clever thing we've reinvented is to pretend we're statisticians around a complex machine learning model. So instead of looking at a data set itself, you look at a complex ML model, and then you do statistics on it. But you can always just sample from that model directly and use classical statistical techniques. That's your testing framework. So that ability is there, but the ability isn't there to rapidly deploy that in different components of your system according to what decisions are being made where. And that's why you need the intermediate language. Once you've got that, we would use this framework for meta-modeling, which is designed for this area of surrogate modeling or emulation, which is a big field in applied maths, statistics, and some machine learners, which one would call probably uncertainty quantification. And we believe that these techniques are the right techniques to use in this case, that we can build a mirror of what's going on underneath. We don't have to control what those software engineering teams are doing, but we're deploying supervisory models that can be redeployed rapidly according to different questions, according to whether the ICO is in the house or the VP is in the house, to try and get the explanation of what's going on in your subsystem. So back to how does that connect to the news? Because I said that this was inspired by news. Well, point number one for me is this. I'm so worried about the notion that you stop doing the census. So worried about it. The only control we have on these large-scale complex systems at the moment is the fact that they're A-B tested end-to-end. So in a large-scale deployment, after you've done all your fiddling, you think, should I go or not go? Shall I make this change? You then do an A-B test. So an A-B test is a large-scale randomized controlled trial that tests whether this treatment of the system is actually giving you a good outcome. And that's the only real answer we have. The rest of it is messing around with happenstance data that isn't correctly, necessarily properly corrected, that comes from potentially dangerous origins. So to me, I worry so much that we fall into this trap of thinking that we can stop doing classical statistics. It's very similar to this Xerox PARC story, where at Xerox PARC they were like, oh, well, clearly everyone's going to use computers and we won't need paper in the future. We'll work out how to do the paperless office. Well, what happened? I mean, since the 70s when they were doing that, we're still using more paper than they were using then. There was more business than ever for printing and copying because actually the computer caused paper to be produced. And we're in a very similar position. We're going to need more classical statistics than ever before to validate and verify these submodels. And the idea that we can just sort of say, oh, well, why don't we just look at this statistic, or why don't we get this data out of here, and then we'll be able to reconstruct the census, just seems to me highly alien. It fits into something I call the big data paradox, which is, the big data paradox is that what you see is going on in our society today is we're measuring more and more, and we're understanding less and less. So we can't even predict elections anymore. We can't target drugs to the right people anymore. Now, there's a number of reasons for this going on, but at the heart of this, what's going on is intellectual debt on a society-wide scale. That we have built systems that we don't understand and can't explain. We don't understand the dynamics of when they change. So the assumptions we're making in one election period about the relevant weightings for telephones by landline, mobile telephones, or internet are totally invalidated by the time we get to the next election. And that's the sort of thing that knocks polls off, because they have those things and they statistically weight them according to previous experience. So if you drop the gold standard with a randomized controlled trial, I think you're really asking for trouble. And I don't know, you know, see, Ian's great guy, and he might be right about the census. But this tendency to believe we no longer need classical statistics is going in exactly the wrong direction. The next thing was the accounting was the third thing. What's the second thing? So this is why you should put these things in your slides. Actually, and they are in my slides. Ofcom. So Ofcom, the idea here is that we're going to be able to deploy teams to regulate companies about what they're doing and to step in and find them when they step over the mark. But this is based on some weird assumption that they know what they're doing themselves. The worst thing, I mean, like, I think the idea under surveillance capitalism behind that book is that there's some kind of conspiracy going on, that these people are actually doing these bad things on purpose to make money, when the truth is, we just don't know that we're doing it. So it's far worse. If it was a conspiracy and there were bad people doing this stuff, we could deal with it. If it's systemic and emergent from challenges around intellectual debt and not being aware when an adversary has taken over your system until a year and a bit after the fact, that's far worse than a conspiracy. This is systemic, and it's going to keep getting worse. I love Cambridge Analytica. They are my favorite company, because they were the ones that were stupid enough to tell everyone what they were doing. They're like a bloody James Bond criminal. For every Cambridge Analytica, think about the companies that are just doing that without telling us. Those are the companies you want to worry about, and we can't identify it because of the intellectual debt in our systems. We can't see these adversarial attacks as they occur. Accounting. The final thing is accounting, which I find disturbing. Accounting, when you think of accounting, it's early data science with decision-making based on money. It's the only data science we have where we believe in the quality of data, because each of those decimal points actually equates to real money. So there's an entire profession caring about the quality of data. If we can't trust the profession of accountants to properly represent, even though there is legislation around it, the true state of an underlying company, if we can't trust them to not be influenced by contracts or whatever else. And why does this happen? Well, because they can obviously the bare figures are the bare figures, but what you get presented is secondary statistics, and there's an interpretation value to that. And of course that's going to be the same in these large-scale data systems. So if we can't trust accountants to do that, how can we trust data scientists who aren't even in a regulated profession at the moment to do the same thing? So I think that the only way is to surge forward, I think that we definitely need a revolution in the way we're building software. This AI fallacy is kind of suspending everyone's judgment around what we're doing. It's incorrectly suggesting these machines will adapt to us. But the reality is a much greater need for the explanation of decision-making. I mean, so the thing that gets to me is that we were painted this dystopian future where we're all going to be the slaves of the superintelligent AI. That's a great future in comparison to the actual future, that we're all going to be slaves of a super ignorant AI. And we don't even understand why it's doing those things to us today. That's actually kind of the situation we're in today already. How many times are you swearing at computer systems or cars or whatever interfaces, right? So there's just more of the same, unless we can get on top of explaining things at a system-wide scale. That's basically the message I wanted to say. Thank you.